All right.
All right. Cool. So I mean, the hardest thing to do with these is the introduction. Like, I have no idea how we want to start this thing. So I think we're just going to wing it. So welcome to the very first episode of the Two Track Mind podcast. This is going to be a bit of an experiment for the two of us. My name is Jason, and I'm joined by my co-host.
What's going on, y'all? Patrick from B Squared.
All right. A little delayed on that. We gotta work on the chemistry a little bit when Patrick needs to jump in. This is going to be an experiment for the both of us. I think we've been talking about doing a casual podcast around grassroots motorsports for quite a while now, and have just kept on putting it off to make time for other projects, and finally just decided, like, you know what, let's just kind of get on, hit record, and see what happens. Like I said, we want this to be a bit of an experiment, and in general, what we want to discuss on this podcast is how do we make grassroots motorsports more accessible to people that are motorsports curious, we'll say, as a way to describe it. And, you know, some of the topics that I'm hoping will, over the span of this podcast, cover things like track days, time attack, endurance racing, sim racing, how to build track cars, instructing for track days. Patrick actually has a ton of experience there. But I guess one disclaimer that I do want to make is, of course, we are not professionals and we do this for fun. We're hobbyists. And actually, I think, Patrick, one thing that you said in a post a while back really resonated with me on this, in that you called it, this is just cosplay.
Yeah.
You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So our team, we have a 8-hour endurance racing team. In Canada here, it's called the LD Racing Canada Series. And basically, we have this Scion FRS that we've wrapped in like a GR-type livery. And our team kind of comes in with matching like Toyota GR clothing. And so we're not officially sponsored by Toyota Canada. We don't get any funding from them. We call this cosplay because, you want to talk about accessibility. Getting into any sort of like racing outside of the grassroots scene is just ungodly expensive to run, even at some of the grassroots level. Like, arguably a Formula 1600 campaign is still grassroots. You know, you're not televising these races. It is a prestigious series, but typically you're probably spending around 10 grand a weekend for a rental program. If you're a privateer, you still need to buy what is essentially a $90,000 race car brand new. So for us, we call it cosplay because we're doing the racing series that we can afford. But we want to feel like we're doing something a little bit more special.
I feel special.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. For today's episode, what we wanted to do is kind of introduce ourselves, right? Now, the plan for this podcast is to bring on guests, because you're going to just get so bored out of your mind just listening to the two of us blab on about cars to infinity. We're actually going to try and bring on people who are more subject matter experts in a few different topics. But for today, I think it'll be great for the listeners, however many there are of you, maybe just a handful, and that would be amazing if we get more than one, just to kind of introduce the two of us, and we'll be kind of interviewing each other. And these are all softball questions, but we'll hopefully bring out a little bit about our motorsports past and kind of the decision making and the journey that we've each been on, because, you know, it's not a very linear process, and there's a lot of ins and outs, and depending on where you first got introduced into motorsports, the journey could be quite different. So I'm going to kick things off, Pat, and I'm going to ask you, tell us about your first car that was your own car. So not, you know, the family car that you got to drive on weekends, but what was the first car that you had the title to?
I had this Audi A3, which was, what idiot buys a front wheel drive Audi. Well, I wanted the one with the manual. So I had this Audi A3 and this was the first one under my name. It was stick. I was in university at the time, so I'd never been introduced to the track scene. My understanding of car culture was modifying a car and going to meets. So like a lot of VW Audi owners, it's a flash tune, a fancy intake, and like a rear sway bar, some coilovers. And I thought I had a really cool car. I had some like spacers on it. It was like stanced out really cool. And I did take it to the track a couple of times. I got introduced into the scene from a friend who was crewing for a drifter in CSCS. I hadn't known like this, the track scene really existed in that way until I started going to CSCS. And I was like, whoa, regular dudes are like taking their cars out and competing. This is really cool. And this is something I want to do eventually. So yeah, the story behind this Audi is that I took it to the track first time, some check engine light for some odd reason. Second time, I actually blew the motor in turn one at TMP. And it's become such a meme corner, right, for us locals, because TMP is sort of the playing ground where most people who are getting into the track scene, that's sort of like their starting point. So for most people going into turn one, they think they can just huck the car in like what they see in movies or if they play from video games and whatnot. And that's usually not the case. And for me,
you go flying off.
Yeah. Well, I did go flying off once in the A3, but what actually, I think after reviewing my video, what caused the engine to seize up was actually an early downshift. So instead of like braking and then downshifting, I downshifted really soon and it just brought the revs up way past the red line. And then at the exit of turn one, I'm like, oh, the car has lost all of its power now. And a very expensive lesson
to learn. Was this a new car that you...
No.
Is it a new car that you got or was this secondhand?
Yeah, this was like a secondhand car I got on used market. It was like a 2010 car. And then when I took it to the track, it was like 2017. So I'd owned it for a year and a half and then started taking it to the track.
Yeah.
It's just,
having an Audi for your first car, like, how old were you back then?
I was 21.
Yeah. That's pretty fancy.
Yeah. So the real first car that was, that I had was a Toyota Matrix that I just like street drove.
Right.
I got it from like a car auction when I was like 19. And,
wow.
On Christmas morning,
Pontiac vibe.
Yeah, exactly. I had a second generation car, XR model with like a 2.4 liter, whatever, automatic, still under my mom's name because at the time, like insurance is cheaper or whatever. Christmas morning, one of these years, somebody runs red light and I T-bone them. It's my green. I'm accelerating. I T-bone them. And that's the end of that car. So the way I was able to afford the Audi was the insurance money that I got from the Matrix, because with the Matrix, I got it from an auction for, I think, $8,000, but they gave me $12,000 for it. And the Audi was $12,000. And I was like, oh, this is the dumbest decision I could make. I could just spend all of whatever money I have and try to survive the semester on like money I earned from a co-op job.
That's a classic story. Yeah. I feel like a lot of people would be able to relate to that. Yeah. It's, you know, it's actually kind of funny because so on the topic of first car, so first car that I had was a Mark V GTI.
Cool.
Which basically
is the same thing.
The same car.
Yeah.
as your A3.
Yeah.
And, so I got mine. This was like, I was in fourth year of university and, you know, by senior year, you kind of, for me at least, I was fortunate enough to know what I was going to do after I graduated. I was just going to go back to the same company that I interned with. And so I was just looking for dumb things to waste money on. And I kind of explained it to myself as I want to give myself a little bit more freedom of mobility, you know, just to get around town and to, you know, run trips to Costco. Cause of course everyone, so run trips to Costco.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got a Mark V GTI DSG, which, you know, I didn't know how to drive stick at the time, and the dual clutch transmission kind of sounded fancy. I didn't really know what it was all about. So I got that. And that was an amazing daily driver. And I think probably the main reason why I actually got myself another one all these years later into a Mark VI, which is currently our family car. And that has been pretty amazing. But, you know, with the thing with I guess, A3s and with GTIs is like, they're kind of like gateway drugs to motorsports, right? Where it's like, you know, it's a respectable street car. But then with VW, even though the aftermarket isn't as crazy as like, say, like Honda, there's still like a decent amount of parts out there, right? And so this kind of transition to my next question, which is, what was your first mod on that first car?
First mod was H&R lowering springs. Yeah, and I was so happy to like finally join like the lowered car community. I was living in Brampton, going to school in Mississauga. In Mississauga, they have this pretty popular car meet spot for high schoolers, which is this like Tim Horton.
Exclusively for high schoolers?
So it seems. There's a lot of degeneracy there, even today.
Yeah, okay.
But I always felt left out because I was like, I couldn't afford a car in high school. All the cool kids could. All the guys in my auto shop class could afford them. And I was like, yes, finally, I get to be low. And it's like a set of like $300 springs. And I was so excited about it. And I'm still a stance boy to this day. So.
Did you do the springs yourself or did you take it to a shop?
Yeah. I rented some spring compressors from Canadian Tire, did it in my garage. And then that was my first foray into like spending intimate time with European cars. I'd done a couple of co-op jobs in the past where I worked at like small garages. And you know, I've never had to like actually use a spring compressor until this point. So it's terrifying.
Yeah, because I was going to say like that is like I've seen some sketchy decompression tactics on springs, and none of them inspired any confidence in what people were doing. So that kind of piqued my interest in asking, because I know like, you know, lowering springs is a pretty common thing for people to do, but yeah, doing it safely is kind of sketchy. And so did you just like rock whatever random alignment you had afterward?
Why does that seem obvious? Because it's exactly what happened. I didn't go to get an alignment. My steering wheel was crooked for months after. Oh man, that's so funny.
All the things you learn about, right? Like it was like, yeah, so now when you think about it, I'm dropping the car, I better get that aligned afterwards.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
So yeah, I mean for me on the GTI, the first modification, I'd imagine this is probably like for most people number one or number two on the list of first mods. So I did an intake.
Yes.
And it was because, you know, I wanted to be able to hear some of that induction noise and a little bit of the turbo, you know, because you can't hear it at all from factory, right? So I got a new speed in cold air intake.
Yeah.
Which, of course, everyone always likes to say, oh, cold air intakes are basically hot air intakes when it comes to simple modifications. But what I remember about doing that mod was just how painful it was to get the hose onto the turbo outlet, because it was so tucked in the back and at the bottom. It was just like those are basically my first of a lifetime's worth of scraped knuckles, and just started there. And it was probably like the first time where, and again, becomes a bit of a pattern where you have a little bit of a regret to doing a modification where it's like, why did I do this again? Why did I think this was going to be cool? What you thought was going to be like a 10-minute thing is like, oh, I'm just putting a pipe on an outlet, and it ends up taking like 2 hours because you literally just can't squeeze a tool down there to try and get it to seat properly. And then when it is seated properly, you just like, oh, did I get it square? Did I get it right? It's like, is it like hanging off on the backside? But yeah, that was my first mod. And I guess it was entertaining for like the first 2 days of driving it with a little bit of a choo-choo noise, but yeah, it wears off pretty quick.
I had the carbon APR intake, which did not have
Is that the Carbonio?
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
So I had one of those, and I thought I got it on used market for a few hundred bucks, and it paired well with the APR Stage 1 Plus 2, and I thought I was, I thought it was some hot stuff with the new tune, but the car was like, whoa, this is like way faster than it was before, and I hear like the, like what
did
I
you actually feel it, or is it just all noise?
The tune is what I felt. The intake did nothing.
Okay.
Yeah,
you did too.
Yeah, the tune. Just I was like, wow, that's really cool that I just like paid somebody a couple hundred bucks and suddenly my car is faster. Where in contrast with the current VRZ, I just paid you a very large amount of money to gain 100 horsepower by forced induction. So
I mean, there's a reason why like everyone was looking to Cobb, right, to make a tune for the 86 with the what are those devices called again? The I know this.
Access port.
The access port, exactly. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, when's the access port tune coming out? And I think smartly, they avoided it because maybe I would think like people's expectations were probably going to be too high, right? For a flash tune for a non-turbo car.
Yeah.
You know, Open Flash kind of took over that space, and I think they made a really good product. But I think it's true. Like people would have been disappointed, especially if you were coming from a turbo car to flashing the access port and only getting like, you know, 10 or 15 wheel horsepower at best, you know, with aftermarket headers or something like that.
Yeah.
But
NA is very tough. It seems
but
like
it's got its own perks.
It does.
Yeah.
I don't know what made me do the jump from NA to supercharging. It was mainly in part due to like testing out other cars. I was like, okay, I could go Cayman. Test drove a Cayman. Yep. Didn't like the gearing. And I was like, okay, well, what package can I get that's like small, has good gearing for Ontario local tracks, and has more power? Well, I can just add more power to the BRZ, although expensive. Still a pretty competent package, which you yourself drove for a few years as well. So I'm like, okay, you know what?
Yeah.
I trust Jason. He's good.
Yeah, so I guess to catch people up who might not know then, right? Like, have you started talking to other people and telling them your plans on this?
I haven't posted about it, but like amongst friends, I'm like, yo, dude, I bought a supercharger and I'm very excited.
Yeah, so I guess cat's out of bag. Patrick is finally supercharging his first-gen BRZ with the Jackson Racing C38 kit that actually came off of my car. I guess we can get into this a little bit, but yeah, so I've been driving my FRS, doing a little bit of an aside here and jumping timelines, right? So like my main track car is an FRS, supercharged for the past couple of years, custom headers cracked, and you know, I was kind of thinking about doing a K swap for a while now and decided to pull the trigger. And the timing was very fortuitous because you blew up a motor this past summer on your BRZ, which, by the way, had an amazing run. Like, what was it, 220,000 kilometers?
Yeah, 225. Yeah, it was a lot. 225, 5 years of probably 10-plus track days a year. No oil cooling for four of those years. And the failure mode was actually a set of rivets that were used to assemble the Morozzo oil pan baffle. And the rivets came off and got sucked into the tube. So it wasn't even a fault of the engine. It was a fault of the product I installed into
the
oil.
That's
the
first time I'm learning about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Yeah, when Adam, my teammate on my endurance racing team, he took apart the old motor and saw that the rivets were missing and there were cracks in the oil pan baffle. So he basically just removed the lower section, because the top half is what, you know, prevents the oil from sloshing away from the pickup tube. So that baffle is currently in a friend's car on a motor that he rebuilt. But the failure mode was an aftermarket part. The motor itself had 220,000 kilometers on it, 225, and it was going really well. Yeah.
See, that's why I always get nervous around new aftermarket parts where, you know, it's like OEM has put so many hours behind every single part that needs to be qualified into a motor, right? And so, yeah, I mean, just for something like a rivet to be the end of the motor, that's
sad.
That really sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know, like, with Gen 2 right now, that's like the biggest concern is oiling, especially around, I think it was like right hand turns, that oil pressure is dropping a lot. And so there's so much research in the aftermarket right now trying to rectify that situation. So, you know, hopefully they come up with something that's a pretty good solution. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, it's tough. Like, now I'm personally in the process of like building a K24 and just seeing all the different things that could screw up in terms of like a random foreign object kind of getting picked up somewhere or not tightening something properly in the assembly. Yeah, that's always going to be bothering me in the back of my mind. And just kind of once it's sealed up, you kind of just like, you know, knock on wood, say a little prayer. Hopefully things stay together just right.
We were on the topic of making motorsports a little bit more accessible to newcomers. And oftentimes newcomers are coming from a place of a build and they want to start tracking a car that they put together. You're in this process of creating this K24 swapped FRS. How do you cut through all of the jargon and misinformation online from maybe people who are a little bit more misinformed?
Yeah.
How do you make sure you're doing all the right things?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess to preempt this, the best car to take to the track if you're just getting started is something as close to stock as possible, right? So like what I'm doing right now is knowing that it's going to be like a multi-year process to kind of figure out what works and what doesn't. If it doesn't work the first year that it's fully assembled and running and not performing well, that's okay because I have time and I have other cars that I can drive and I'm not going to beat myself over, you know, putting all this time and money into this car that isn't quite there yet because it's going to be a bit of a diamond in the rough, right? But to your question around it, like cutting through misinformation, because it's true, like the internet, especially in car culture, can be a pretty toxic space, right? Different subcultures have their own different quirks, right? And in the track community, I think there's definitely a lot of keyboard warriors around what works and what doesn't. And the best way to cut through the bad stuff and just focus on the good stuff is really looking at what are the shops that have participated in competition programs, right?
Yes.
And have put together a package that they themselves run. Right? Not just one that they commercially offer and have their customers run, but like, are there packages that they themselves have run in like endurance racing or in time attack, right? So for me, I had a lot of help in chatting with the guys at K-Power because they run their cars in time attack. Ironically, my car is going to be more similar to their Turbo Miata build than their FRS builds because they've mainly been focusing on NA stuff. But I think that the longer that you kind of are in this time attack and endurance racing space and you want to maximize your seat time, right? Which this is honestly like that's what it all comes down to at the end of the day is like how do you have more time on the track? And it doesn't necessarily have to be like with the most like extreme car or the fastest car, but like you just want to be out there. Like, the thing that sucks the most is that you show up at the track, your car's not running well or something breaks, and then you're just kind of like watching your friends go on and lap. And of course, they'll take you along for rides, but you'd rather be out there, right?
Yeah.
And so with that goal of maximizing seat time, you start to realize that it's like you want the car to be reliable, right? And so can you just use junkyard motors when your current one blows up, right? Because that's also another mentality of everything is a consumable when it comes to tracking, right? And I think that's just the reality of it. Like nothing you need to concern yourself with when you're first getting started, right? Because I think a lot of times people will over prep their cars, not only for like performance, but also like for reliability. Mm-hmm. Like you yourself said, you didn't even use your oil cooler for the first couple of years. Yeah. And I know a lot of people that would say like, oh, don't even bother tracking an FRS or a BRZ without an oil cooler. But we all know it's okay. And then we all know people who have done it for a couple of years. Not ideal, but again, it's not something that you need to have as a mental block preventing you from taking to track, right? So yeah, like look for shops who have proven it by actually competing with their own products. Have the mentality of nothing is going to last forever. And so have the plan of how do I replace something that becomes consumed, right? And so I like things that are like high volume off the shelf.
Yes.
That I don't have to worry about like, hey, oh, I got this thing made custom and the guy who made it for me no longer does this, right? And then you're kind of screwed, right? So
yeah.
Off the shelf, I think is always the best. Yeah, long-winded answer, but I think that's probably the topic that we'll cover quite a bit as we go on into the future as well. Yeah, for sure. So my next question was kind of touched on this a little bit, but let's talk about our first track day experience. How about you go first?
First track day experience. Okay. Well, mine was cut short because I as I mentioned earlier, I was in the Audi and then I got like a check engine light. I was so green. The green is very new to all of this scene. And for me to have some potential engine problem, which like my little hand scanner couldn't solve at the time, just by like, you know, erasing the DTC and praying it doesn't come back.
Because that's going to be the fix for everything, right?
Exactly.
You just
got to
scan and clear the code and you're good to go.
I can't. It's so funny how, like, a lot of guys, like, I don't know, we share so many of the same memories. We live, none of our lives are actually unique.
True. No special snowflakes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My track day was cut short. I was terrified. I was like, oh no, this is going to be expensive. And I did not have the mentality of things are going to break. Things are going to be replaceables. Definitely didn't think the engine was. I was okay with like tires and brakes getting worn, like actual consumables. But I guess if you're in the space long enough, you're right. Everything is a consumable. But on your first track day, that's definitely not something you want to be thinking of, especially considering you just spent quite literally all of your money on it.
And I don't think it's not the right mentality to have for your first day too, because like you don't want to be like stressed out before you even show up, right? But it's just like kind of take baby steps kind of thing.
Yeah.
What was your preparation like for that first track day? What did you do ahead of time?
I mainly focused on the car because, you know, I've been playing Need for Speed for all of these years. I'm basically
you're an expert.
Driving god,
you're an expert.
Right? So I was like looking up what brake pads to put on the car. I just to make sure they don't get overheated. The one thing I didn't focus on that I completely ignored, mainly out of budget, was the tire. I was on a set of like Continental all seasons and they were screeching the entire time. And to me, I was like, yeah, this is performance driving. The tires are screeching. My hands are shaking. I feel like every single YouTube video I've watched about track driving. And despite the driving being like poor, like I went back and watched the footage after a few years of elapsed of me actually learning and getting coached to track drive. I was like, I don't regret the way that I was driving before because it was my first time, but it was also such a eye-opening experience compared to just driving on the street all the time. Like this is the moment where I like completed like the first couple of laps. I'm like, oh, okay, I can do this essentially forever. This is great. I'm gonna keep on doing this.
So much fun.
Yeah.
I always tell people because the one thing I love to do is like bring my friends to the track the first time and just have them, you know, sit passenger. And I love it because the experience for them almost the same every time with different people, but like it's kind of mind-blowing. And I the way that I try to capture that feeling is you're going to be in a very familiar environment in that you're on the inside of a car.
Yes.
but it's going to behave so different than what you're used to that your brain is just kind of confused for quite a while, right? I love bringing people to the track just to kind of see that reaction and get them to be excited about it, right?
So what was your first track day like?
My first track day, it was in 2015. I went to Peter Hansen's school at DET.
Cool. And
that was a great experience. And I, looking back on it, I think I'm very, very grateful that that was my first experience because it was extremely organized, right? And like when you went to TMP, it was just like an open lapping day.
I'm assuming. Right? It was a Friday evening.
That's probably like the most like wild, wild west, you know, everyone for themselves. And then I had like the, and I had the structured school experience where it's like, you know, you have the in-class session with Peter's dad back in the day and then skid pad session, right, to do braking drills and then track sessions. And, you know, you kind of like, when for your first track day experience, you're just like, oh, I want to maximize the time in the car on the track. But to be honest, I think it was great to have like the classroom sessions, just kind of talk through theory and whatnot. And I think it's also been a big reason as to why DDT is my favorite track. Just from like the get-go, right? Just having that experience. And what I remember about that day was it was with my FRS, right? I traded in the Mark V GTI on the FRS, waited a year, took it to the track because, you know, I found some friends who also had 86s that were going to go to this school. It's actually how I kind of connected with our mutual friend, Jason Lee, because he's pretty close friends with Peter, actually, and he was there at this event. And
in 2015?
The funniest, yes, in 2015.
Wow, I didn't know he's been in the scene for that long.
He was a WRX boy back in the day, man.
Gee.
He was into the Subarus. Yeah, you can poke fun of him for that one because now he's just like brainwashed BMW at this point. BMWs are great. But the funniest thing was I remember this, you know, this was my first new to me car and being the excessive worrier, with a sword or anything, like someone who worries excessively. I bought a whole bunch of this like shelving, protective, like a plastic clear wrap kind of stuff that is used
for
like kitchen shelves and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I just wrapped the entire front of it, and with like, painter's tape and stuff like that covering sides. So, like, you know, I stumbled on some forums where like all these like Corvette owners were like, oh man, you're gonna get like rock chips and like scuffs on your car from like the rubber. And of course we laugh about it now because like no one cares. Like even if it's like a new car off the showroom floor, I'll just show up with it without any protection. Maybe you disagree for being a detailer, but obviously like way overboard, and it was, you know, the only guy that had that on my car. People were like coming up to me like, is this a rental? Is this why you're putting this stuff on there? Like, no, I'm just trying to protect the paint. But I also recorded footage of my first track day. I think recording is really important. I still remember, like, I don't think I got below 150 on my first day. And all my friends there were like, well into like the high 40s at the time.
Wow.
This is back in like 2015 when like everyone was like, oh, you know, 145 is the limit for a first gen BRZ FRS, right? No one can beat that. And I think people like honestly believed it because like this was before we, you know, everybody had that collective like hive mind of doing the R&D, like how do we make this car faster? Right? Now it's like, you know, 10 seconds faster than that. It was like a struggle for me. And I think that probably still sticks with me in terms of learning new tracks, that within my group of friends and within our team, like we all, with the exception of Chris, who's just like an alien, like nobody can touch his lap times, but the most of the team like usually ends up around the same lap time plus or minus a second at any given track. And but for me, like I always tend to like take a little bit longer to learn something. Some people are more natural and intuiting a track, but for me I kind of need to feel it out and try different things, and then over time, this is my line and my approach. But I do find like ever since the first lap day, like I'm tend to be like back half of the group in terms of acclimatizing to a new track.
Yeah. No, it's cool. You had that community though when you first started out. Going to an open lapping day when I first started, I had a couple of friends from university that also took their cars, but none of us had prior experience. None of us had been to a school. And the people that were around us, you know, we were kids at the time. We're not going to go up to someone and be like, hey, can you show me how to drive? We obviously thought we were all there was. So having that start and a community of people that like just collectively pushes you, I only found that to be like way more important, I think, almost too late. Like you should almost find sort of like a home with a few people early on. I don't know. That's one of the things that really helped me grow is having like-minded people all chasing the same goal. And even if there's a competition space, it's grassroots. You're not barring anybody from learning. They're not barring you from learning because there's nothing to win here. Everybody's just here to have some fun. So that's cool that you had you had guys like Chris and Jisung and your circle. That's awesome, dude.
Yeah, and I think that's like probably my biggest piece of advice for people getting into grassroots motorsports is you can't see it as a individual sport or activity.
Yeah,
even if like it's almost ironic because like it's only you out there driving in the car, sure. But it's very lonely to be doing this by yourself, especially when you think about, you know, rule of thumb for going to a lapping day is usually like one day in the garage, one day at the track kind of thing, right? And to be wrenching on a car by yourself is like one of the worst experiences about this hobby. And I think like the early days of like lying on your back, it's cold, and you're like trying to bolt up an exhaust hanger or something, like, you know, and you have the car running because you want to check for leaks and you're inhaling all the fumes and trying to figure out like, it's like stuff like that, right? Like you just don't want to be doing that on your own. Time just goes by faster. You make fewer mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think the worst experience would be like, you know, God forbid you have an incident at the track and you don't have a plan on like, how the heck am I going to get home? Yeah. Right. Like that's the kind of experience where like, if you have it, you're probably not going to do this activity ever again if you don't have the right people around you to kind of be like it's, you know, it shit happens, and at least you have a ride home and people will stick around with you to figure out like, hey, how do you get the car home and stuff like that, right? So that those are like the moments of truth in this hobby where you kind of need that group, right? And you know, we'll probably in a future episode talk about like how do you find that group of like-minded people, because I think that's worthy of a discussion itself.
For sure.
But yeah, definitely a very important part of this hobby. Yeah.
Yeah. You also started with school, and I currently teach at that school now. I'm an instructor there. And
yeah. At Hanson?
Yeah. Nice. I instructed several days this year, and I think you mentioned about the skid pad, like you're so focused on being on the track, and people often do sort of overlook skid pad training and autocross type exercises. But I think the biggest gains that my students this past season were able to achieve were actually on the skid pad, especially on like the big, like large radius, trying to get the car to both understeer and oversteer. For them to get used to inducing those behaviors, I was like, okay, do you remember what happened last time at the bottom of turn 12 at DDT? It was super tight. You turned the wheel and the car wasn't steering. You're going to do that on purpose here, and then we're going to try to remedy that. And then, you know, the skid pad training, they tried a couple times. They're like, oh, yeah, actually, there's a point where the front end just doesn't want to listen to you. And
just
they go out.
Go anymore.
Yeah. Yep. And then they go out into turn 12 on their next track session. They're like, oh, okay, I understand. I have to maybe brake a little bit earlier or release the brakes in a different way. And all of a sudden, the car is listening to me again.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. For new people.
Big aha
there,
moments.
Yeah. I'm big on like deliberate schooling and training for specific facets of your driving. I think it's so beneficial, and you take that with you to every single track day for the rest of your racing career, quote unquote.
Right. But that speaks to kind of, again, like what we discussed earlier, very familiar thing, but extremely unfamiliar behavior, right? And so when you have that mentality of like, oh, you know, I play Need for Speed, I play Forza, right? I've also been driving for the past 10 years. Like, how different can this be? And everything, and this doesn't apply just to like track driving, right? Like most activities, when you're at the cutting edge or the knife point of something, it's all at the margins and the behavior is very different. Like the concept of oversteer, understeer, you know, even like people who show up on the first track day, people don't understand or don't have a really good concept of like a motorsports alignment and how much that has an impact on the behavior of a car is like astounding, right? When it clicks and when you start to realize it, right? So I think like maybe the takeaway here is when you want to start track driving, your enthusiasm comes from a place of your prior experience and that you know this is going to be something you're really interested in, but you want to have an open mind and that like you will be mind blown in terms of the depth of knowledge and different mechanics and different physics that you're going to learn through this hobby, and know that because, you know, at the very end of your early days, right, when you started thinking about like, do I want to compete? Do I want to do endurance racing? Do I want to do time attack? All your gains are going to be at these margins. And remember, you're going to be eventually, hopefully, right, just racing for tenths, right, or lapping for tenths. And that's going to come from these minute details that make all the difference, right? I mean, it's great to like, I'm glad, like you said, I'm glad to have gone to a school. But you know, the interesting thing about schooling and with instructing is, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this because you do a lot more instructing than I do, is how do you as a student know that you're getting good instruction, right? Because I do hear, you know, sometimes like we have friends who have done some schooling that they just feel like either they felt like they were like held back by their instructor, which I'm sure like a lot of people feel that way if you're a little bit hot-headed, or just didn't feel like maybe they got conflicting advice between different instructors. Yeah. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think I'm by no means a like seasoned pro. I've only been instructing, I think, for the past 2 to 3 years. There are instructors who've been doing this for like 10 to 20 plus years, with far more experience and probably a different answer than me. But, I think in my perspective, when it comes to matching an instructor to a student, it's mainly the instructor's job to get an understanding of what clicks for the student. So I usually prioritize, early on learning if the student is more visual, meaning I need to use more obvious hand signals, or if they're more like audio learning. So if I need to speak louder or be more explicit with the commands that I give, or more brief with the commands that I give, every student has some level of understanding that, you know, from whatever upbringing they have, this is the way that they prefer to learn. So I think the best pairings that I've had with students, I don't think I've gotten bad feedback or like mismatched feedback from students thus far. But I'm mainly trying to mold myself to what the student wants to learn. So to figure out their goals and play to what they want to learn, so they come out of the track day feeling accomplished. I've heard some stories about some instructors not allowing some students to, you know, push as hard, and understandably, like I've only gotten dangerously off track a couple of times. I've hit a wall with a student driving in the past.
Really?
They were driving an Ariel Atom at Supercar Experience Day, and they just shifted while they were cornering. The car spun, and we backed right into the wall at Calabogie. I think some instructors are a little bit more conservative, obviously for the preservation of life. But also, I think there is some sort of prejudice, depending on what car or how modified it is.
Mm.
I think some instructors, they'll see your car, especially if it's like over modified, and you come up with like some level of confidence or ego, whatever it may be, they may try to limit you from the beginning because they feel like you're going to be at risk, which is unfortunate because it can be a misjudgment. Or on the other hand, they probably have enough experience to say, oh, I've sort of seen this driver profile before. This is uncomfortable for me. I'm going to try to take more control of the situation. I completed a course for driving instructing hosted by what's called the Motorsport Safety Foundation. And they have a level system for instruction. So, you know, first is a written test. Then the level two is like an on-site test by other instructors who graduated through their program. So getting formal training and trying to read the student's preferences. You'll know if they're like an A-type or a B-type student based on the way they present themselves to you. Even their decisions with how they modify their car can play a role into, you know, how they are sort of set up mentally. And again, we're not trying to judge people, but the training exists because over the years of instruction, people have been able to categorize drivers into some sort of bucket as a starting point. It won't be the, you know, be all end all, oh, all drivers with big wings are jerks and they just want to push way too hard. That's not true.
Yeah.
But it does give us a starting
point. I would be labeled if I showed up, right? With my Type 7
Vortex,
car, you know,
like
1600 millimeter.
Yeah, exactly. You're like giant Vortex wing, half cage, supercharged BRZ, FRS. But what are you doing at a school? You should already be just doing advanced group lapping. So sometimes they can have the assumption that you're probably like just finished this build and you just want to take it out for a rip. And we ask these beginning questions like, hey, what do you want to learn today? What are your goals? How much experience do you have? So if a student comes by with like a very over-modified car and they're like, yeah, but I've only done a couple of track days. I've never been to this track. I don't really do any other forms of practice. Then the instructor's like, okay, we're not going to tell you to slow down, but we will say, all right, I'll drive the car to what I think is probably about 60% of what you're capable of. And I want to see if you can just match this consistently before we start to push. So the verbiage and the language is so important. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Have you ever just tagged out from the beginning? So like, I'll give you a scenario, right? Like what if you have a 16-year-old driver that shows up with, you know, their parents' Audi R8 and it's their first time on track? What would you do?
Supercar experience and a lot of these exotic car lapping day experience type coaching.
Yeah.
You actually wind up in that exact situation. Although it's not their parents' car, they've paid for like three laps in a Huracan Performante. No track experience ever. This was a birthday gift for them. So, you know, they're going into a car with like a G2 basically and with insane amounts of horsepower and performance under their right foot. So I haven't really walked away from that situation, but I do stress at the beginning. I'm like, okay, you're in here for three laps. There are other people who are going to drive this car after you. Let's preserve each other's lives. And as long as you listen to me, I will allow you to push the car to your limits. And I make it specific for them so they don't feel like I'm limiting their capability. I'm trying to grow their skills. And what ends up happening is if you get the right student with the open mind, you know, they'll come in at the beginning with like a Red Bull Formula One shirt. And you know, they're like, oh, there's an enthusiast type here. Some people even bring their own gloves and you're like, okay, so this person obviously has an intention to really push this car. How do we take control of the situation in a way that still takes preference to their enjoyment.
I think we can talk about this topic for a very long time. Yeah, sorry. And to be honest, probably will. No, it's great because I think I'm thinking we should do an episode on coaching, training, coaching the coaches kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm super, super interested in hearing more about the course that you took from mm-hmm. the Motorsports Foundation.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the you've already mentioned some things that are really interesting for me to think about, which is like, is there a mismatch between how prepped a car is and the fact that a driver is coming in as a student to learn how to drive on the track, right? Like, that's not something that I think about too much. Like, maybe I would say, oh, like, they're just looking for more, like, advanced coaching. But chances are, like, maybe it's probably closer to what you were saying, which is like, yeah, they just finished a build. But yeah, I want to learn more about the Motorsports Foundation. And one of the things actually from me watching and just being a fanboy of some of your videos is like, I want to learn about those hand signals because for some drivers, that's yep. huge, right? To be able to have consistent hand signals that many coaches use, many instructors use, I think that would be super helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Those are also standardized within the Motorsports Safety mm-hmm. Foundation, standardized mm-hmm. hand signals.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. Before that, I was just like, I make up my own, right? You know, this means go, this means stop.
Yeah, yeah.
on the topic of like getting that right mentality when you just match up with a new student, I think some of my biggest mistakes in trying to help instruct people, and this is usually with close friends, right? Yeah. Where I'm like, now you can do this, you can do that. And I think my biggest mistake, and they teach you this in any instructor school, which is don't be the first one in the car to drive it at the limit with the student, right? Like, because then they get it in their mind that like, oh, if Jason or Patrick can do this, then I can do this too, right? Like, they just demonstrate to me, I'm going to go and do that, right? And eventually they could probably get there and they probably will. It's just that you don't have you don't have the subconscious reactions and feelings, right, on driving. Because like, as you will find out when you progress through tracking and driving, is so much of it is inactive, in that like you focus on the minute details with your active mind when you're driving, but the 99% of the driving, it's all kind of muscle memory at that point. Subconscious, exactly, right? And that's the biggest thing. And probably like a great reminder for people who have done one track day or two track days to remind themselves that because driving at the limit is mostly subconscious, like don't beat yourself up too much about it, because the first time you go out there, you're basically driving 100% consciously and trying to think about every single little input. Yeah. And you're not unlocking the superpower of your human brain to help you drive just yet, because you need that additional lap time and seat time, right, to make that happen.
Yeah, to build muscle memory and to enter flow state. If you're a professional in any field or you're like really proficient in any sport, it's a commonly known human behavior that you enter this sort of like flow state where, especially like in for me driving, I'll do a whole 20-minute session and not remember anything out of it. I don't like, especially in endurance racing, when I'm in the car for like 2 hours straight, I remember the first couple of laps.
2 hours already?
Yeah. I remember the first couple of laps. I remember the last couple of laps, everything in between. Even if I'm like, even if there's like passing involved, like, okay, I'll remember I made a cool pass here. But then you go back into the flow state when you're just, you know, not a lot of traffic, you're just lapping. And you don't really think about like actively what you're doing. You're looking, you're using your vision. And your vision dictates mm-hmm. everything else. And I think it's not something most newer drivers understand until they start getting more seat time. And they're like, whoa, what just happened? And I've had it. Mm-hmm. I've had this happen to a student where they enter some sort of flow state. And there is a mismatch between their ability to enter flow and skill level it takes to perform in the subconscious. They use muscle memory, but it's from poor training or lack of training or just lack of experience. So they end up going off track, and I'm trying to get the student to respond, and I'm like, hey, are you there? And It takes them like they're already on the grass. They're still accelerating. I'm like, hey, hold on, let's stop here. And they're just unresponsive. And this can happen to you. It's terrifying as an instructor when you're in the zone and the student's like off track and they're like nonverbal, non-responsive. That's probably the most like scary moment I've had. Not hitting the wall. I knew I was going to hit the wall. I'm just, okay, brace. But when they go nonverbal, you're like, okay, I'm really not in control anymore. They can't hear me and I'm just in the seat. Terrifying.
Yeah. Speaking of terrifying moments, let's go on to our next question, right?
Yes.
Which is, let's discuss personally what our first major incidents on track were like.
First major incident.
Yeah.
Shannonville.
Do you have a personal one?
Yeah. Okay. Shannonville, 2019 Ontario time attack season. There's this corner at Shannonville, corner 11. Which is a right-hand, high-speed, large radius corner. It's the fastest corner on the track aside from maybe turn one. So you're entering at about...
After the back straight you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So in at the time I was driving a stock, pretty much bone stock BRZ with just tires and brakes. You're entering at about 150 to 160. You're apexing at around 100 to 110. And it was, I think I narrowed it down to poor vision where I was looking directly ahead of the car rather than like way ahead to the next corner.
Yep.
So looking directly ahead of the car, you're like, oh, the car isn't going where I want it to go. Immediately you just press the brakes. You press the brakes on a car that's going that fast. You de-weight the rear tires. You're adding more load to the front while you're steering. The car is going to come around and spin. And Shannonville is not really known for its smoothest runoff. So
they could dig there.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. In the next year, a car flipped not too far from where I went off. So it's quite terrifying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first really bad off that I had was in that corner. I was like spinning it probably between 90 to 100 kilometers an hour on dirt. I was like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Try to restart the car. The car wouldn't start right away because the engine was still like way too hot. Gave it a couple seconds and went off safely. But it took me 2 years of really trying to focus on that specific corner every time I went to Shannonville to regain the confidence to apex it at the same speed I was at the beginning. It was such a huge mental barrier for me. But what that did was... really train vision because I watched the video a million times. I couldn't figure out why I went off. There was nobody in front of me. I wasn't doing anything different with my hands, but that split second where you look away from your like long distance viewing really just takes you away from the car. And in that to regain the confidence to go at that speed again, it took so long, but I learned so much about vision. That was later on really beneficial to, again, every single track day that I go to for the rest of my life. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested to see what yours is.
Well, I think you might be able to guess it. But I mean, before I talk about my story, though, you know, what you say about mental blocks, I mean, that's a real challenge because I still have a mental block with the, I don't know if you call it turn. Yeah, it's just the last. Sometimes people say it's the first corner because technically it's probably the first corner when it comes to lap time. But the last corner at TMP, I always have a mental block there because many years ago when I was still just learning to drive, I had a tank slapper there in the FRS.
Ooh.
And when I was in the car, I was almost certain the rear was going to hit the car, the wall, right? Because the rear came out, I overcorrected the front of the car was pointed at the wall for the longest time, and then it caught. So I was like, say if the guys from Speed Academy were there, because they were like filming for one of their videos, and Dave comes up to me afterwards like, man, that's the closest one I've seen in a long time. Like, it was dicey. But yeah, I mean, to this day though, with rear wheel drive cars, I'm still kind of gingerly on getting back to throttle there because it is a little bit bumpy. on the exit. With a front wheel drive car, it's fine. I'm just like, you know, mad as early as I can. I know the rear's not going to come out on me. But mm-hmm. with the rear wheel drive car, I'm still, you know, kind of going like 8/10 through that corner on most days. But yeah, before I talk about my biggest first and probably biggest incident in my entire time in motorsports so far, I do want to say, like, we're mentioning these things not to scare you off from going, but more so I would say to normalize that this is just a part of the experience, right? And, you know, with the car scene and social media, people don't really like to talk about mistakes they make and, like, you know, off-track excursions and stuff like that. And I think it's like the same with any niche, right? Like, people only want to celebrate the successes, which you should do, and it's great. But it kind of paints this like really warped view of what it's like to do this activity, right? And not everything goes right. And so my first major incident was actually our first year of doing endurance racing. Back then, everyone was participating in Champ Car, or Chump Car as it was called back then. And the spiritual successor of that really is Lucky Dog Racing at this point. And first time at Motorsport GP, we were racing our Honda Fit, which we, you know, endearingly called the Fit of Doom. It was actually a really fun endurance car. Actually, at Shannonville, it was great because infield, like, it actually kept pace. But GP was, you know, it's underpowered, back straight, like, can't really keep up. But you can basically be flat almost everywhere. And so this was hour 7 of 8. I was almost done my full stint. And we were only doing like 1 hour stints because the stock fuel tank couldn't really do the whole 2 hours back then. And I was coming up on turn one. We were because it's multi-class racing, we were in the third class. There were two cars in higher classes coming up on my rear on the front straight. And I felt like they were going to dive to the inside. And I kind of gave them a little bit more space than I should have and went offline mid-corner. Now, the problem with GP, Motorsport GP, because it's such a fast track, the marbles on those corners, on the offline, are massive.
Yes.
And so the Fit got caught in the marbles. The rear came out. It was the first time I've ever experienced a rear come out of that car. The issue was, with the momentum and the downhill of turn one, it just kept washing to the outside. There was no way for me to get back to the line. And then it was just basically like very slowly made its way to the tire wall. And I still remember, like, oh, this is like, because the first half of that, when the car came loose, I'm like, I can catch this. It's not bad. But I'm like, oh, I'm running out of space. Like, this is still going to the wall. I guess I'm going to crash. And the two things I remember about that crash, one was the sound was it was like a high pitched bang. And I wasn't expecting that, cause I would have thought it'd be more like a crunch, you know, like of things like compacting. Cause like the car was like totally bent afterward, but it was like all that energy being released was super loud. God. And the other thing was like, wow, my head moved a lot more than I thought it would. And I was wearing a Hans, of course, like we need it for the series, but it's just like the things that you don't really expect or know before it happens, and it happens, and it's like, oh, that was very different than what I was expecting. But since then, you know, knock on wood, like, this was like, it was in the early days of learning how to drive, and so I would like to think that's probably something that I could have avoided now, and not on driving ability, but mostly on having the right approach, which is like, stay on the line. Even if you're the slower driver, stay on the line. Do what's safe for you and just let other people who are trying to pass you in a higher class, let them do it on their own, you know, timing, and let them take the risk to do that because you have the right to your space, right? So, that's my story.
Wow, dude. That's a big, that's a big hit. Like especially if you're in a car that you don't need to brake, you're probably coming in still pretty hot. So going into turn one,
That was a lift car. Yeah, for sure.
Gosh, no man. I think a lot of drivers, when they're even in like the endurance space, you don't really think about marbles until you actually hit them, and then suddenly your car has no traction.
Like, no grip.
I'm kind of spoiled in that I start pretty much every race. for our team. Yep. Like there are a couple races this season where I didn't start, but
yep.
like there's not nearly as many marbles on track when I'm driving because it's just the beginning of the race. There hasn't been as much rubber put down. So
I thought I'd imagine like on the Sundays though, right? Because we raced the day before, there's probably still.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It's weird though.
It's because you have the clear air. You never have to be offline. It's because you don't drive from behind. That's the problem.
Okay. Also true. Also true. If I'm passing, I don't know if we've like created some poor reputation in the series, but sometimes I'm passing.
Yeah.
Like we're in GT1 class. There's GT2, GT3. We're passing a car that I know is like GT3. Sometimes they'll move, and I'm like, I'll take the space, thank you very much, but you didn't have to do that. And
maybe
we have a history of really poor passing. I don't know.
Well, you know, when the rules are based off of braking points, right?
Yeah.
And different cars have very different braking points, it gets a little gray.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially you guys with your lightweight and ABS still and auto blipping, you know, you can basically take the brakes as late as you humanly can.
Yeah, some corners you don't break at all. It's great.
Yeah. I always think about like, and again, like we'll probably do another episode on just many episodes on different facets of endurance racing.
Yes.
But I always dream about doing endurance racing inside of an FRS because it's still for me like the most comfortable cockpit and most familiar.
Yes.
Whereas like for us, like our team, we just keep building Hondas and I just feel like I can't get the right seating position a lot of times. I feel like my ankles and my knees are floating when I'm clutching and stuff like that and can't get the right feel on the brakes. But yeah, like over a 2-hour period, like driver comfort is a big deal, man. Right? Something that
huge.
People don't really think about. Getting comfortable. And that's something that you always learn like first track day as well on how to adjust your seating to drive on track because it's very different than, you know, what you would sit like just putting around town.
Well, see, you started tracking at school. My first track day was still a weekend at TMP and people are driving like this. I'm like, whoa, like
all the way back.
I don't think that's the correct way.
Yeah. No, you gotta be like a keener and just like pull up as tight as possible.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Just like straight up on the back of the seat, no lean, right? Cool. I mean, well, we've been going at this for a little over an hour now, and you know, we can save some content for future episodes and to again bring on some guests as well, so it's not just the two of us talking and bring on some new expertise. But before we wrap up, I want to try this like segment that I think would be great for our guests to participate in as well. And we'll just kind of test it out on the two of us. And the segment is going to be called Modest Dream Garage. So the concept is you get $200,000 and we can say it's US dollars, right? Because, you know, we use Monopoly money here in Canada. Nobody knows what it's worth. $200,000 US. You got to choose three cars and these are the only three cars that you have available to you. And the reason why I like this question is I, you know, going through that thought process and thinking about how people choose and deliberate is going to be kind of revealing about like their motorsports personalities, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, with that said, Modest Dream Garage, $200,000 budget. I'll go first because I have some time to think about it. So you have a little bit of time to think about it and react a little bit. So for me, all right, I got to think about the roles that these cars occupy, right? So if I only have three, one's got to be the family car. But the family car should be dual purpose. And having been tracking for a few years, what I covet the most is a car that can tow. So what I'm thinking, right? Midsize SUV is probably my first pick. For a long time, I was thinking X5 or a TDI Touareg. Right from the diesel days, right? Like a 35D, because they would just tow like a dream. But now that it's been a few years since the last ones have kind of come off the showroom, I don't know if I'm willing to take on like another quote unquote project car because you know, at some point, like it's going to be a lot of maintenance and repair. And I know a lot of people are also like flashing it to get rid of the emissions for diesel as well, right?
Right.
But interestingly, I think that's actually the mid-size category is getting a bit more competition now, and people are kind of cluing in. It's like, hey, people want like these weekend getaway cars that can do a little bit of off-roading. And the car that piques my interest the most right now for like a, you know, family car slash tow car is probably the Land Cruiser.
I was putting it in my hand. I was like, Forerunner?
Yeah, well, Land Cruiser. Basically the spiritual successor of the Forerunner, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, so that'll probably be like, I don't know, like out the door, probably like 75K, something like that. So that's like, you know, a third of my budget. The next car is the way I would categorize this would be personal fair weather daily slash arrive and drive track car. So this is like the one where it's like, I don't want to spend any time wrenching on this more than I need to. And I just kind of like want to show up. Like if it's a lapping day that you bring your friends to, or like maybe you're instructing that day and you just want to bring a car that you don't have to worry too much about, because especially if you're instructing, like you don't have time really to be working on your car in between. So you just want something that works out of the package, right?
That's right.
The car that interests me the most in this category would probably be an M2. And I like the M2 competition, you know, the F series, right? Yeah. The F80 series. I've driven a few of those, ton of fun. But that new G87 just looks insane. Like, I know it's a heavy car. I know it doesn't look very good from the front, I'll be honest. Like, and I think the powder blue makes it actually look the worst.
The pastel.
So I'll probably get it like in black, right? I'll get it in black. But all these like rumblings I hear and videos I've seen on YouTube, it's like, oh yeah, like downpipe and a tune and mixed 700 wheel. I'm like, what?
Insane.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy, right? Like, 700 wheel is like well into supercar territory.
Yes.
And, you know, something that seems like a bit of like a weekend, almost like executive car vibes, because, you know, it's still a BMW, right? It's got like comfort luxuries. That, I don't know, it checks a lot of boxes for me. And I think in Canada, probably close to like 90, 95, right? Yeah. So, you know, not much left in my budget. Third car, probably the most obvious thing for me. So this is the one where it's like the temperamental track car, right? The thing that gets towed around in the Land Cruiser. I'd say at this point, it'd probably be, no surprise, first gen 86 with the K-Swap.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. Just because there's no car that I know better than the 86. And it's probably the same for you, I would assume.
Yeah.
In terms of setup, suspension. And ironically, now I think the K24 is probably the motor that I know the best now, because I'm going through this experience of taking it apart with our friends at Driven Autosport. And so I'm kind of just being schooled by Enrique right now on how to think about this motor. And like we said earlier, lots of off-the-shelf parts, great aftermarket support. So for something that I know that it's going to blow up every couple of years, I think that's the way to do it. So Land Cruiser, M2, and a K-Swaps 86. Those are my three cars.
Damn.
What do you think? You
got to
roast me about my choices.
Well, I think you're at the budget cap limit, which, okay.
Yes.
The rules weren't clearly defined. If all you $200,000 were reserved for spending on cars, you spent on cars.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a little bit more buffer room, I think, for consumables.
That's a smart way. That's a disciplined way to do it, because, like, you know, I get these cars and, like, I have no money to maintain them.
700 horsepower weekend car? Your M2 with a downpipe and a
crazy,
tune,
that's
insane. That's nuts.
I'd probably just keep it stock, though.
Yeah. I mean, I'm of the same mentality, but we're also endurance racers and we think a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Your average time attacker probably be like, I only gotta do 10 laps today. let's do something crazy.
Exactly.
No, I don't got any roasts for you, man. I think
no.
As soon as you listed your first vehicle as being a body on frame tow vehicle, I'm like, okay, we're the same person.
Yeah.
None of our experiences are unique. We're NPCs, essentially. Because Yeah. If I can
boring.
Get into my choices as like Forerunner, like something that can tow, big trunk space. One of my teammates, Vin, who is an avid overlander, when we started racing, he used to put a tent on top of his Forerunner, sleep in the tent. I'm like, dude, I can live in that thing. I can camp with it. I can take it anywhere, road trips. I can drive it to BC, do some like rock climbing or like snowboarding, whatever I want to do. I have this Forerunner, and it's not so big. The Land Cruiser, Vin had a Land Cruiser for a bit, the newest one, and it's huge. It's huge. I think the Forerunner is a little bit shorter, so that's what brings me to it, and it can still tow.
Yeah. Right.
The next car I'd have in my garage, I've already married my BRZ. Very similar to your FRS. Yeah. Like we put the half cages in our street cars. Or
I don't think I can ever get rid of it.
No, there's no way. Somebody would have to crash into me. I'd probably just take all the parts off and put it in another car. Like I just know these cars so well. Like I love them. They're so fun to drive. So at this point, I've probably only spent what the Forerunner is like probably going to be 60 grand, BRZ 30 grand, so I'm like 90 grand in. My next car is this is where you and I start to detract.
Deviate a little bit, huh?
Yeah. My next car would probably be if I can get my hands on like a Formula 2000 or an F1600, some sort of open wheel car.
Open wheel, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cuz you know, I got the truck. I got the fast street car because the BRZ, you know, I've already supercharged it. It's still going to be super competent.
Fast is relative.
Well, for our tiny Ontario tracks, I think these cars do very well.
That's true.
You're right. My answer could be a little bit more different if I lived closer to, like, I don't know, VIR or Watkins Glen. Actually, Watkins Glen's pretty close. I'd like the BRZ because I could take it as a daily, exactly how I'm driving it right now. It's like modified, it's super cool. I like driving around in a car that like people are like, "What the hell is in the back? What are all those metal bars?" And I'm like explaining, like, "Yeah, this is my baby. This is my thing that I've worked on for a few years, and it's the like summation of my racing personality, and I love it." But then when I want to go driving and the vehicle that I'm going to tow to the track is going to be, I think, an open wheel formula car. They're just so cool to me. For a time, it was like a radical, but then I've been talking a lot with.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you, like, why not a radical? Yeah.
Well, they're a lot cheaper.
I
think you can get into like an early 2010s SR3 for like 40 or 50 grand now. On the flip side, to get a brand new F1600 probably be like 90 US. Maybe I can get one for 50 to 60, like Canadian on used market with some spares and whatnot. I don't know. I've been watching a lot of content from like Matt Clark, who's like an up and coming Canadian driver in the Indy circuit, and he was talking about how the limitation of sort of grassroots open wheel driving is sort of the F1600. To graduate from that to doing like F4, like he's now in USF Pro 2000, like these are way more expensive series to run. I think peak grassroots open wheel racing, if that's F1600, then I will have an F1600. I'll be very happy to drive one of those. Yeah.
Is there a series in Canada that you can compete in with that?
Yep. F1600. Yep. It's under the Canadian Autosport Clubs. So you go to any CASC sprints weekend, they'll sauce in the open wheel cars or Formula Libre, which you can compete against other radicals.
And that would mostly just be at Mosport then, right?
Mosport, Calabogie, Shannonville, I believe.
Shannonville, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Be really bumpy there.
Yeah. Like, The car, I was talking to Joseph Yang about this, who is Joseph is an Ontario Time Attack previous competitor, and is now he runs his own race engineering business where he coaches for a lot of other teams, including a pretty successful F1600 team. So I think I'm heavily influenced by his experience, and he's also given me the cost breakdown of running one of these cars for a weekend. So if you have the car, once you have the car, you're probably, if as a privateer, spending anywhere between $3,000 to $5,000 a weekend for, I think, 5 or 6 weekends in a year. So it's too far off. Like, it's definitely more than what we spend for Lucky Dog.
It's kind of like double what a driver would spend on Lucky Dog.
Yeah. The seat time is a lot less because it's sprint racing. But also, you're in a formula car that does 128s at Mosport. Insanely fast. I'm like, I can't even.
Different experience.
I don't think I can get to a 128 within the first few years of driving that car. So it would really be such a high ceiling and peak grassroots in terms of affordability before you like go off the deep end and have to find sponsorship to go run F4 or some other series.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Dream car.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you get one, I'll definitely try. Take it out for a lap.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I'll just bring up Richard, take out one of the radicals for a day or something like that.
He's expensive. I think he'll charge $5,000 for a test day. I mean, not expensive, like any other.
For a test day?
Yeah, for a test day.
It's all relative, right?
All relative, yeah. If you try to rent a GT3 Cup car, you're probably doing $5,000 for an hour. So, yeah.
Have you ever done the... is it the Bridgestone school?
I did not do that. I came into racing after they ended that program. Yeah, but those were with...
Oh, they don't run that anymore. Right, because it's all Porsches there now.
That's right.
Porsche experience.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, missed
cool program, though. I know of a couple people who graduated from it, and a lot of them are still in racing today. Few instructors at the Motorsport Safety Foundation here in Canada were graduates of that program. Right. It's cool. I wish I did it. Yeah, they have aero on those cars. Yeah. The 1600s don't. Interesting.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps it up for all the things we want to cover for this first episode.
Yeah.
Hopefully that gives you listeners some idea of what to expect in the future when we start bringing other people into the mix. I guess before we wrap up, Patrick, do you have anything you want to pub or any people you want to shout out?
Yeah, for sure. Shouting out the people we mentioned in this first episode. So we did mention Speed Academy, so shout out Dave and Pete. We mentioned Driven Autosport, shout out Enrique. All the people that make this community as healthy as it is. I think we're at a really healthy state in Ontario Motorsports where, you know, we have our shops. There's plenty of shops that are actually competing in local racing, and it's so nice to see different options and different knowledge bases. So yeah, shout out Dave and Pete for like starting off their YouTube series, making days way cooler for all of us by making like benchmark lap times.
For sure.
And guys like Driven Autosport, 13 Motorsports, been a huge supporter of my racing for the past few years. Lee's Auto Works, who Eric helped me get into instructing at Hanson. So other things we've talked about in this podcast, just huge community shout out to all the people that have made this such a like high value community.
Yeah, for sure. What about some of your own endeavors there?
Oh, I mean, okay, I do run a motorsports coaching sort of consulting business called B2 Motorsports, and we do track day instruction. So I coach with different schools, or our main product as of right now is our virtual consultations. So if you are a track driver, you have collected a subset of data from a track day and you want to get improvement from either yourself or your car, we can help you with that. So you basically pay us for like a session. We evaluate your data. And then we either join you for a call or give you some sort of a report so that your next track day, you have a very specific game plan for what to do to get faster based on your own data. So we do provide that service. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to shout it out here, Jason. That's us at B-Square. You can find us on YouTube and Instagram mostly.
Yeah. For sure. And again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but that data analytics and telemetry, I think, warrants its own episode as well. So we'll definitely, do some discussion around there and see, like, how do you make that approachable, right? Because it's a huge advantage, right? Like, I think there was so much discussion in time attack this year through Ontario time attack about, like, how much time is it worth to be able to log your data, right? Is that something that should, if you're using a data logger, should that be pips, right, during a competition? So maybe we'll bring like some huge data evangelists. Like I know Jason Lee is huge on it. Maybe we can bring some people from B-Square and have a discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Other people I want to shout out at WCT Performance, Ed from WCT. The guys who run Razor Track Days, huge supporters of grassroots motorsports as well. JRP, huge supporters. They're actually helping me out with my K24 Turbo DCT, hopes and dreams build. So shout out to them. I think, some of the other stuff that we mentioned on this episode, like endurance racing, time attack, we'll definitely want to do an episode about how to get into endurance racing. Hopefully we can get Chuck, the CEO of Lucky Dog Canada, to join us for an episode. Definitely want to dedicate at least an episode to Time Attack because, we the two of us have been doing it for a while and all of our friends are really in the Time Attack community. So we'll try and get some people from like OTA, Ontario Time Attack, see if we can get Kevin on the line, just talk about the rule changes that are coming up for the next season as well. Tons of stuff. And would love to engage with the audience as well. If you guys have any questions or topics that you want covered, people that you want us to try and bring, no one's off limits in terms of at least we'll shoot some emails to people if they want to join the two of us and just goof off for an hour and talk about motorsports. If you are interested in this content, consider liking, commenting, subscribing, sharing. We would greatly appreciate that and it'll help to get us the feedback that we need to continue to improve this and to make it more enjoyable for you guys, the listeners.
Yeah.
And I think that's about it. Anything else you want to say, Pat?
No, I'm all good. Yeah, looking forward to doing some more of these. This is really fun.
This was fun. This is the problem with car people is that you give them an opportunity to talk about car stuff. It just goes on and on and on forever. Like, I don't know if you ever been at a party, like my wife will get really annoyed when somebody asks me like one question tangentially related to cars and they're expecting like a 30-second answer. And then it's like, 30 minutes later and they're trying to run away from me as quickly as possible.
Oh, yeah.
So with that, let's wrap it up and we will catch you guys possibly, probably in a few weeks. We'll try to line up another guest to enhance your listening experience. All right. Nice. Take care.
Take care.